This is Charles with the Barbershop Podcast. Today I'm going to be your host, and today we're going to interview Genesis Gomez, a licensed mental health counselor out of Coral Gables in the Miami, Florida area, and she focuses on addictions, guys. But that's not all. You know, Genesis is a bilingual licensed mental health counselor in the state of Florida. She earned a bachelor's degree from Florida International University and got her master's degree in mental health counseling. She focuses on addiction and family therapy. And one of the really cool things that she's also been able to do recently is she's been able to work with unaccompanied minors under the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And, just so everybody knows what that's about, you know, that's about the children who have been separated from their families because of some of the policies that were put in place here in the United States. So we definitely give her a huge shout out for working with those children and their families. That is a really, really big deal. So guys, you know, as I said, Genesis, she focuses a lot on addiction. We're going to get heavy into addiction today because I just feel like it's a good opportunity to talk about it. You know, one of the things that I saw probably within the last 2 weeks was that, let's see here, there's an actor. Yeah. Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck is back out of treatment, and I'm a little bit concerned. And I don't know Ben Affleck personally. I just know my own struggles with addiction and also working with people in addiction. And I know that things don't happen overnight. And I remember seeing the photo of Ben and his ex-wife in the car as they were transporting him to a treatment facility. And I was just like, man, you know, my heart goes out to him and his family, his children, just everybody, anybody who knows him. And, you know, a lot of people look at people like Ben Affleck and they say, well, he's got the world. You know, he's a big time actor and women love him all over the world and everything. Like, why can't he just get it together? And that's not how it goes. And we'll talk about that today. And there are a lot of people, you know, other than Ben Affleck, there are a lot of people who struggle with addiction. And some people, you know, may struggle with it and we don't even know who they are. I can recall getting in touch with a schoolmate who used to live in my neighborhood years ago as a teenager. And my heart dropped when she told me that one of her cousins passed away. And I was so shocked. I believe it was a cousin. It may have been a brother, but he passed away. And I said, well, what happened? I thought maybe in a day of an age of guns, somebody murdered him. She said, no, he overdosed. And then she told me right after that, hey, and do you remember so-and-so? I said, yeah, we all played ball together. And she said, well, yeah, he overdosed too. And they were just months apart. And what's interesting about this is that these two individuals were not rural white guys. Okay. They were not rural white men. They weren't older white men. They weren't young white men. These are African-American men. And I say that to say, you know, a lot of times when we hear about addiction stories and stuff, we tend to hear about this happening with the status quo. And it's not just impacting the status quo. So, Genesis, it's good to have you on today. I thank you for spending some time with us, you know, and let's talk about addiction and sobriety and all that stuff, because I think that this is something that it's commonplace with men, but I still don't think we're really having a conversation about it, even though it's very mm-hmm. common. So why aren't we having that conversation?
I think it's a tough conversation to have. And I think there's still so much stigma surrounding addiction and mental health in general, just as a country, right, as a culture, and then in all the micro cultures within the country, there's so much stigma about it that if I'm a man and I say I'm struggling and I can't handle my alcohol, then all of a sudden that makes me less of a man. And what man wants to be less of a man, right? It's a very vulnerable conversation to have. And that's something that I think humans struggle with, vulnerability, but I think it's especially difficult for men to be able to say, I'm not capable of doing something on my own. I need assistance.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah. And we talk a lot on the show about men and vulnerability. So yeah, there's always, it's just something about us that we do not like to put ourselves out there, you know? So You know, when we're talking about addiction, there are two main areas I think that a lot of people focus on. They talk about getting clean or sobriety, and they talk about recovery. And, you know, I don't want to steal your thunder and things like that. But I mean, what's the difference, I guess, between sobriety and recovery for guys?
Okay, so let me start with recovery, and let me kind of tell you a little bit about recovery. So recovery is this ongoing process, and it's a process where the individual is going to make significant changes in different areas of their life. That means, for example, they're going to maybe take care of their hygiene now. Okay, they're going to take care of eating right. They're going to take care of their relationships. They're going to take care of their financial responsibilities. They're going to take care of their jobs, their education, their career path, their friendships, their emotions. So there's this wide range of changes that happen in someone's life. And it's not something that you achieve. It's not something you check mark and you say, I'm recovered. It's this ongoing process because we're constantly evolving as human beings. So there's never a time where recovery is over. Whereas sobriety is just, I'm abstinent of whatever my drug of choice was. I'm just not using anymore. I'm not engaging in that anymore. But there's really no other profound change that's happened in my life other than I can take a drug test and it will come out clean. So I'm still living in chaos.
I see. Okay. So let me ask you a question then in terms of sobriety and recovery. Like say for instance, you know, a guy was going out on the weekend and he was just getting hammered on the weekend and he's been in treatment or he's going to, you know, AA or something like that now. And, you know, the thing is abstinence is much better, but where is he if he's not getting hammered anymore, but he's not abstaining from alcohol? So where would he be?
You know, different people will tell you different things about that. And even the research is kind of split on that. There are some models that say, you know, you want to strive for moderation when possible. And there's some models more like the AA model, for example, or the NA model that absolutely preach 100% sobriety. What I can tell you from my own experience working with clients is that that is a very slippery slope. And so someone might be able to manage alcohol, for example, or manage maybe smoking weed at a more controllable rate for a couple of months, for a couple of weeks, right? But eventually, they derail and they're not able to continue that moderation because life happens. And so it's really easy for us to go back to what we know helps, quote unquote, right? So the accessibility that I have to something is going to make it easier for me to abuse it. There was this interesting study that they made based on Vietnam veterans. And so what basically the study proposes or explains is that most of the Vietnam veterans were using heroin overseas just to deal with a lot of the physical pain and alignments that come with being at war, right? And they were abusing the heroin. The heroin was readily available to them. It was given to them. You're in pain. Here you go. Right. But once they came back and kind of had to be back in civilian life and readjust to their regular lives, heroin wasn't readily available back then as it is now. So for them to go ahead and find heroin, they really, really, really have to go out of their way. And it was very much stigmatized back then. It was not something that you saw. It was not something that you talked about. And then a lot of them came back to homes where they had family waiting for them, family that was happy to have them back and had the support from their family members. So they were less likely to develop an addiction. One, because they had a supportive environment, but two, because in their environment, they couldn't find their drug of choice. So even if they had the thought of, oh, it would be really good to get high today, like today is a crappy day and this would really make my day better, that was not an option for them.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. So, you know, you mentioned recovery, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, they would say, yeah, I'm probably in some recovery stage, but then there are a lot of people who need to be in recovery who aren't. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys who probably need to see someone who aren't, somebody who needs to go sit in the room who doesn't. Mm-hmm. So like, what are some of the obstacles to men, getting into recovery programs or even like going to NA or something like that?
So I think there's a couple of them. Just thinking about the idea of recovery can seem really boring and can seem just like this chore that I have to endure and that I have to work on day in and day out. And it's just, I think as a society, we give it like this negative connotation. So if you think of maybe a 21-year-old man thinking, you know, I can be out with my friends or I can be doing all these different things, living the college life. And instead I'm going to go and sit at a meeting or I'm going to go to a group session or I'm going to go and spend an hour with my therapist. It just sounds boring, right? It just sounds like it's this huge project that we need to like do. And there's not like, it's never completed. So it's this ongoing thing. And again, thinking it from the perception of a young man, it might seem like I have to be doing this for the rest of my life. I may be doing this for like the next 60 years of my life. It just seems very daunting. So I think it's really changing that perception. That is not to say, again, that recovery is something we shut off. It is something that's ongoing. It is an ongoing process, but we don't have to give it a negative connotation. I think that, it's all on perception. And research has shown that people who have sustained recovery report a higher quality of life prior to them starting addiction. And so we know that people in addiction fall into addiction for several different reasons, but not everybody necessarily does because they've had this traumatic childhood. You know, maybe you ended up in addiction because you had a really bad breakup when you were 20 something. Maybe this was your high school sweetheart, they broke your heart and you found your escape in addiction. But other than that, you had a pretty decent life. Even compared to your pretty decent life, your quality of life goes above that when you have sustained addiction. And when you compare someone who, I mean, recovery, I'm sorry. And when you have someone who's in sustained recovery versus someone who's not an addict at all, and has never been an addict, and you compare their quality of life, that person in sustained recovery has a higher quality of life. And so why is this? Because someone who's in recovery is very self-aware, is very aware of their emotions, is very aware of their triggers, is very aware of how they function. They're constantly seeking a life of balance because they know when things get out of balance, things get ugly. And it's kind of, it's a very difficult situation for them to put themselves, very risky situation as far as relapsing. And they're also very careful to be in healthy relationships. They know how to set healthy boundaries. They know when to let go of toxic relationships. And they're very much held accountable for their actions. They've learned that they're held accountable through a sponsor. They're held accountable through a program, through their own family members who maybe been through therapy themselves or to support groups. So they're constantly being held accountable and responsible for their actions. And so when you combine these elements, it makes for a very rewarding and fulfilling life, and a life where you feel supported, you understand yourself, and you can strive to really live that best life. It's really an opportunity to live the life that you deserve to have, that you've always wanted to have. I think the difficulty is that we don't always believe that we deserve this life. Like it sounds good. This is my ideal life. This is what I wish I had. But we a lot of times feel guilty and don't think we deserve it. And I think that's where therapy can really help, is help you envision that life and believe that you deserve to live that life and that it's possible.
Yeah. So, talking about making some heavy changes in order to sustain, recovery, make it through recovery and get to sobriety. So, a lot of what you're speaking about is self-care stuff.
Yes.
And these are you touched on these wellness areas. It sounds like to me that once again, we're hearing, someone say that, well, guys, you have to do a better job taking care of these areas of your life. And that's a big thing that we kind of come back to all the time. If you're in a room and you ask guys, hey, what do you do for self-care? It's just like, yeah, no, self-care among men is still a very mm-hmm. new concept mm-hmm. because they identified it so much with the feminine that mm-hmm. they didn't even think about it. And I always say that wasn't always the case. At some point, in time, men were involved in different types of productive hobbies and different things that aided in their wellness. And then at some point we fell off the rocker. Okay. I wanted to ask you about process addictions when we're talking about lifestyle changes, because I don't think a lot of guys really know what process addictions are. So can you just give us an example, maybe one or two examples of process addictions that men struggle with?
So process addictions would really be any behavior that takes the place of that substance, of my substance of choice. So maybe my substance of choice was cocaine, and I'm no longer doing cocaine, but now there's this other behavior that just takes my whole focus. And so the same way that I felt about cocaine is the same way I feel about this behavior. I may feel that I can't go through my day without engaging in this behavior multiple times. The one day that I can engage in that behavior, I have high anxiety, I feel restless, I can't focus, I can't sleep well, and I can't function. It takes me so much time and it to be able to engage in this behavior. Like, I devote so much time to the process of this behavior that it's also damaging other areas of my life, whether it's my relationship with my significant other, with my kids, my ability to work or be effective at my work, my friends, my hobbies, all that stuff. So if you look at it, it's going to create the same damage. It might not be fatal, as some drugs can be fatal, but it's going to create the same chaos in someone's lives. The tricky thing with process addictions is that they often come with good intentions. And so these process addictions might be things that your doctor, your therapist, your friend, your priest might have actually even recommended for you to do as part of your healing process and your recovery process, but with the intention that you did these in a balanced way. And so the problem is when we lose that balance again. Balance is so, you know, pivotal in recovery. And so process addictions can be to exercise. So you may, maybe you had anxiety or anger problems and they told you, go exercise them away, right? And they said this with the best of intentions, but if you're spending 5 hours at the gym daily, then that becomes problematic. And it's not only the chaos that it can bring to your life, but even physiologically, you can be causing harm to your body by overexerting yourself. Food is a big one, and I think is one that we often don't talk about, but food is a big one. And so if I'm eating away my emotions, if I'm eating away my stress, then I'm using this in an addictive way. Sex, pornography, masturbation are also big ones. And I, you know, typically when I talk about this with my clients, they kind of laugh and they're like, how can you be addicted to sex, right? And so there's a big difference between having a high sex drive and being addicted to sex. And someone who's addicted to sex will just have sex with anyone, regardless of whether you're attracted to them, regardless of whether you're in a relationship, regardless of whether you have condoms to be safe, regardless of the situation that you're in. It's just about the action of having sex rather than that emotional connection or the fact that, you know, you really find your partner very attractive. There's also definitely gambling, and I think that's the one that we've been talking more about. It's finally been recognized by the DSM-5, and I think there's just a lot of propaganda out there about gambling, and that's definitely a serious one. Gambling and sex addiction are the ones that have the highest suicide risk just because of the chaos, the pain, and the stigma with them. I mean, no one wants to be shamed by their entire family and kind of social circle from losing everything and having their families like living under a bridge because they gambled everything away. Or they don't want to, you know, discover, have everyone in their family and their social network discover that they were having sex with everyone. And so now they're getting a divorce and, you know, probably the significant other is taking a big chunk of their money. So very shameful situations that lead to suicide often.
So let me ask you this, because this is, you know, this is extremely important because I deal with this a lot of times. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously you're there in Miami, and it's a diverse community there in Miami. Mm-hmm. But obviously, as a bilingual therapist, you deal with a lot of Latino men. Okay. Yes. And I can also tell you that I also deal with a lot of African-American men. And one of the things that I get a lot of pushback on is, sex and porn addiction, these aren't addictions that Black men or Hispanic men, these aren't addictions that those men deal with. Do you ever hear people come to you? Do they come to you and say those types of things to you?
Mm-hmm. I think that's very common. How can you be addicted to sex? How can you be addicted to porn or to masturbation? They're natural. But that my response is the same way you can be addicted to food. It's natural too. It's a desire. It's something that your body needs. And it's something that is essential for you to live or to live, you know, a healthy quality of life. But when done to the extreme, it can be very harming. But there's definitely a lot, I think, of disbelief that that's actually a problem.
Yeah, I hear you. So, you know, moving along, and we're running short on time, I do want to get your thoughts on codependency. You know, for I would say maybe 3 or 4 years, it seemed like that became the buzzword for everything that somebody exhibited. You had these armchair psychologists and therapists, not really therapists, just people with opinions. They learn a term and then it applied to everybody. So for men, what are some of the things you're finding regarding codependency in men? What is it looking like out there?
So I think for men, it's really difficult for them to be vulnerable. And so to really get raw with their emotions and get to the core of things can be terrifying. It can be very, very, very scary. And so part of recovery is really doing an inventory of your life and really doing a lot of soul searching and doing this not one day, but doing this constantly. It's an ongoing process. So at some point in that process, I think men become really overwhelmed with it. And they kind of get this thought of, I can't do this. This is too much for me. And so they find a way to shift your focus into something else. And a lot of times that something else is women or men, just another relationship with a significant other. And so by shifting my attention from myself and my healing, which should really take priority, because if I want to have success and stability in any area of my life, recovery has to be my priority. I'm acting in a codependent manner because I'm putting someone else above my needs and completely neglecting my one most important need, which is working on my recovery so that I can stay healthy. So I think that's probably the main way that I would see that in men. It's what jokingly people call it 13 stepping. And it's just at some point in treatment, men feel so overwhelmed that they seek relationships as a way to not have to think about their problems, as a way of feeling better, as a way of just having excitement, kind of getting that high in a different way, and not having to look inside and not have to be just observant of what's going on within them.
Yeah. So, and one of the other questions I had for you, you know, talking about codependency and relationships is this, and this exists in different communities around the country. There are guys who've been raised to think that they have to be the protectors in relationships. They have to be the fixers in relationships. And not only this, not only is this found in families, right? But as I said, cultures, there are,
absolutely.
I know that for African-American men are told from, you know, from infant stages and on up, right, that they have to protect their sisters. They have to protect mom. They have to protect Black women or this and that, right? And I know that there are some corollaries in the Hispanic community as well. Do you think that that sometimes fosters some codependency for guys?
Most definitely. Codependency is something really that affects the family unit, right? And so when someone develops codependency, it's something that they usually saw at home in their family of origin. That's probably how they saw maybe their parents or their siblings kind of relate to each other. And so they kind of learned to be the caretaker and to kind of take on the responsibility of other people's behaviors, other people's emotions, and other people's just kind of thought process. And so if that's what I'm seeing, and I'm not seeing anything else, because that's what I'm seeing, not just in my family, but even in my culture. So when I go to my friend's house, my friends also, I see that in their families, then I believe that to be normal. And so it can, again, just be very easy for me to slide into those behavior patterns. And that's where being really honest with ourselves and continually being self-aware and setting these boundaries is really crucial.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about is that one of our goals and one of the things that we focus on is continued care with a barbershop group. We're not talking about mental health as a trend. This is what we're here for. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to jump on somebody's stage. This is what we're here for. And my concern, and this may be something that you've thought about, but my mm-hmm. concern is that a lot of individuals see celebrities and everybody talking about mental health, and that's great. And maybe they decide, hey, I want to try this out. I want to see someone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, individuals don't understand the scope and the breadth of mental health a lot of times. So, you know, I think it's one thing to have mental health first aid, and there are a lot of people focus on that. But what does continued treatment look like?
So continued treatment would be what would happen after maybe you've been to detox and been to a residential treatment center for maybe 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. That's definitely not enough. That's just sobriety, right? And maybe the foundation or the first step of recovery, but that's not enough. Recovery really starts when you're on your own, you're back in real life, you're not in a bubble, and you have to make decisions and really have to hold your own self accountable, because there's not someone constantly watching you and telling you what to do and what not to do. And so that may look like a partial hospitalization program where someone is going 8 hours a day to a program where they're receiving group counseling, they're having self-help groups, they're learning basic life skills as well, and then they're seeing an individual therapist. Then maybe after that, they're doing an intensive outpatient program where maybe they're only devoting 9 hours a week to therapy. So it's a little bit less. It allows them to maybe go back to school or get back to work, but still have a lot of support. They're still receiving group sessions, and they're still seeing a therapist once a week. And then after that, you would have regular outpatient, which is where you would see your therapist once a week for an hour, and just kind of do therapy individually or do therapy with your mother or with family members, which I think is really important. I think, in our culture, we try to make it about the individual, and the individual is the addict, and they're the ones that have the problem, and they're the ones that need to go away and get fixed, right? And then they come back to the family. But addiction is really a family disease. And so if there's a lot of toxicity within the family and those relationships, going to make it really hard for that individual to succeed in recovery within that family unit.
Yeah, that's good information to have. So guys can be clear about what the process really, really looks like. You know, so guys, you all have been listening to Genesis Gomez. Okay, she's a licensed mental health counselor out of Coral Gables, Florida, and she works with South Miami Psychology Group down there. You know, you guys can follow her on Instagram at the Miami Therapist, and she's also on LinkedIn. We'll make sure that you have that included in the show notes. Guys, again, you know, if you are in need of assistance, if you need to reach out and talk to someone, or if you're kind of still, you know, skeptical about getting help, go ahead and follow her on Instagram. She puts out a lot of videos and information for you all, and it just may be the thing that you need in order to get the help that's out there for you. It's a lot of help out there for you, but it doesn't happen overnight, as you heard her say. It's a long-term thing, but it's a good thing. So, you know, Genesis, I thank you for spending some time with us today. Your information was very, very spot on. It's something that men need to consider. I don't think we think about recovery a lot. I don't think we think about process addictions a lot. And I definitely know we don't consider how codependency impacts us. Again, even when it was used and people started talking about it years ago, it was something that they wanted to point their fingers at women about. And I don't think that we look at ourselves enough for it. So really, I do thank you for your time, guys. We hope that you have enjoyed the show today. Again, check out the show notes for all of the links and the information. Reach out to her if you need to. And, you know, we know the weekend is upon us, guys. We hope that you all will be safe. Don't drink too much. If you drink, spend time with your families. Take care of yourselves, and we will talk to you soon.
Hey guys, Riley here. If you're enjoying today's show and would like to hear more, you can gain access to member-only content by going to patreon.com/thebarbershopgroup. We aim to provide as much value as possible to you and the rest of our community, and our listeners play an important role. So if you want more content, or if you're just happy to support our mission and the other men out there, head over to patreon.com/thebarbershopgroup to contribute today.